Welcome to Radio Derb, ladies and gentlemen. That was one of Haydn's Derbyshire marches, and this is your genial host, John Derbyshire, with news and views from the past week. We'll go straight into it with a little acoustic guitar music to balance out that Haydn clip.
Just fit the battle of Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. Just fit the battle of Jericho, and the walls came tumbling down. Now there's no man like Joshua.
That actually was a Joshua, the great Josh White, singing the old spiritual Joshua Fit the Battle of Jericho. And here comes Barack Obama, giving an address the day before Martin Luther King Day at King's Old Church. Obama used the Jericho story as his main theme, noting that those walls didn't come tumbling down till everyone shouted in unison. Therefore, said the senator, we have to be united. Who's we in that sentence? We Americans? We Democrats? Given the date and the venue, it sounds like it's we Black Americans. But politically speaking, Black Americans are just about the most united group in the country. Close to 90% of them vote Democrat. That's not united enough for Senator Obama? Then he got into a long riff about an empathy deficit, an empathy deficit. Now, empathy, according to Webster's Third Dictionary, is, quote, the capacity for a vicarious experiencing of another's feelings, volitions, or ideas. So what the senator's getting at there is, we're not feeling each other's pain as much as we ought. Or perhaps just Black Americans aren't. It's really difficult to nail down Obama on that first-person plural pronoun. Supposing the senator is right about this, what should be done? To his great credit, Obama doesn't beat about the bush here. What should be done, he says, is the government should give us money. Passing over once again, because I honestly do not know, who the us is in that sentence, that is the main thrust of Obama's speech, the central message that he's trying to deliver. The government should give us money. Quote, we can't celebrate Dr. King's dream and yet still have insufficient funds to cash that promissory note that was promised at the beginning of this nation. End quote. Obama could have saved us all a lot of time if he'd just cut to the chase and repeated Bob Geldof's famous line from the Live Aid concert back in 1985. Give us your f***ing money! Obama kept returning to this theme. Quote, we must push our elected officials to supply the resources to fix our schools. Newsflash here, Senator. That was already tried back in 1987, when federal judge Russell Clark took over the Kansas City School District and imposed huge tax hikes, first on the city and then on the state of Missouri, to fund extravagant spending on the city schools. They got Olympic-sized swimming pools, state-of-the-art computer and broadcasting labs, wildlife sanctuaries, planetariums, model United Nations chambers, Latin lessons, fencing coaches, the works. By the early 1990s, Kansas City was spending more per student than any other school district in the country. What was the result? Dropout rates nearly doubled. Attendance rates dropped from 82 to 76%, and test scores didn't budge. So maybe money isn't the answer, Senator. Oh no, don't tell Obama that. Quote, we can't pass a law called No Child Left Behind and then leave the money behind. End quote. Another quote. Insurance companies, drug companies don't want to give up their profits. when, of course, we all know that they should give up their profits. They should give up their profits to, you know, us. Somebody should make them do that. Why are these companies allowed to have profits? Well, perhaps for the same reason this country is called the United States of America and not the People's Republic of America. Meanwhile, over on the GOP side, we're down to just one Conservative in the race, since Fred Thompson and Duncan Hunter dropped out. My man Ron is holding up pretty well, though. He actually got a silver in the Nevada caucuses, with two-thirds of independent voters going for him. Limited government conservatism isn't dead yet. At least, out there in the West it isn't. On the other hand, John McAmnesty won South Carolina, picking up 24 delegates. He didn't ask his pal Edward Kennedy to campaign for him. I don't know why. Nor did he explain to us how a candidate who thinks we should stay in Iraq for 100 years, if necessary, can win a general election in a country where 63% of the people are against the war. Nor has he yet clearly backed off his promise to push 12 million trespassers to the front of the immigration line, ahead of people who've been waiting for years in their home countries to get a residence permit for the USA. All that John McAmbiguous has said is that he'll do something or other to secure the border before he hands out goodie bags to the lawbreakers. Meanwhile, we've been hearing some juicy stuff about Mike Huckabee's decade in office as governor of Arkansas. Apparently, Mike didn't do much for the Republican Party in that state. In fact, he left it worse than he found it. According to the Washington Times, Huckabee actually funneled Republican Party funds to Democratic candidates in the state legislature. Huck says that he was just, quote, building coalitions. I think the definition of building coalitions is letting Democrats have their way in everything that matters. Ah, if only Democrats were as kind to Republicans as Republicans are to Democrats. Arkansas now has a Democrat governor and 5 more Democrats in the state legislature than when Huckabee took office. It's also lighter by 1 Republican U.S. Senator and 1 Republican U.S. Congressman. But hey, it's packed tight with those wonderful coalitions. That's the important thing, isn't it? I tried to build a similar case for Mitt Romney's Massachusetts, but the darn place is so irredeemably Democratic, Romney's governorship was just a blip. The new governor of Massachusetts is a chap named Deval Patrick, a much more traditional Democrat type. His first action on taking office was to change the governor's car lease from a Crown Victoria to a Cadillac. I haven't seen any news stories about Governor Patrick building coalitions with Republicans in his state legislature, but perhaps that's just because he hasn't been able to find any. And then we have the economy. I get a bit nervous here because I don't believe I understand the economy at all. I sometimes suspect, in fact, that the national economy, not to mention the international economy, is a bit like quantum theory. If you think you understand it, then you definitely don't. What matters, of course, is not whether Radio Derb understands the world economy, but whether our government economists and the people who run the central banks and the folk who issue and guarantee the big bonds, whether they understand the world economy. Do they? We're about to find out. There are certainly signs that those big guys are worried. The Federal Reserve just gave us the biggest cut in short-term interest rates for 23 years. Very nice if you're on the debtor end, which of course the USA mostly is nowadays. Every debtor needs a creditor, though, and if the rest of the world decides that it has better things to do with its wealth than swap it for shrinking dollars, then Katie bar the door. Our president has worked up a short-term stimulus package to get us all busy getting and spending again before a real recession can kick in. How's he going to finance that package? Why, by borrowing money from willing foreigners, that's how. And again, if those willing foreigners turn significantly less willing, you'd better get your mountain bike oiled up, because you won't be able to afford to run your car. And this is the happy scenario, a big, long US recession. The ugly scenario is a worldwide depression, caused by a total collapse of the debt markets, and reinforced, as the last one was, by protectionist measures demanded by struggling electorates in democratic countries. Still, look on the bright side here. As I said, I don't know squat about economics. And, as Sir William Harcourt said to the young Winston Churchill, "My dear Winston, the experiences of a long life have convinced me that nothing ever happens." That was way back in 1895, and, as we all know, nothing much has happened since then. Oh, wait a minute. How could I have got through my campaign spots without mentioning the Clintons? It's more and more clear now that what I told you in last week's Radio Derb is true. The Clintons and their party are giving up on the black male vote, figuring that if they can get Hispanics and women, that will more than make up for the loss. There you see the problem with identity group politics. If some other identity group promises more votes and more influence than yours, then you can kiss your candidate goodbye. Or, in this case, hasta la vista. Politics is not a sentimental business. If it was, the Clintons wouldn't be in it, because when sentimentality pills were being handed out, the Clintons had stepped out of the line to go shred a few billing records. Latest from the Clintons. Senator Obama was consigliere to a Chicago slum landlord. Senator Obama thought that Republican ideas, like tax breaks for evil Wall Street fat cats, were just wonderful. Senator Obama waffled on key issues when he was in the Illinois legislature, voting present instead of aye or nay. Senator Obama is a shill for some nuclear energy company keen to dump radioactive waste in our backyards. Senator Obama has a secret room in his basement where he tortures cute small animals. Oh, this is great fun to watch. Underneath it all, though, is a melancholy truth. That once the civil rights movement had done its work and unjust laws had been struck down, black solidarity was a losing strategy for black Americans. As an identity group, they are now homeless. The Democrats don't want them. They probably never really cared about them, for all the flapdoodle about Bill Clinton being our first black president. The Republican Party welcomes black Americans as individuals, but has mostly refused to pander to them as an identity group. Worst of all, by yoking themselves to the Democratic Party for all those years, black Americans signed on to the open borders lobby, thus bringing about their own dispossession. My advice to them now would be to vote for Ron Paul. However, the signs are, so far as one can see the signs, deep down in that humongous hole they've been digging for themselves this past 40 years, the signs are that black Americans are still digging. OK, listeners, here's a pop quiz, so get your pencils out. What is the flattest country in the world? Now, this is nothing to do with the Radio Derb item of a couple of weeks ago, when I informed you that, with a few trivial exceptions, the United States is the fattest country in the world. We've all got over that, you know, with the help of a milkshake and a bag of Cheez-Its. This isn't fattest now, this is flattest. So, what's the flattest country? Answer, which I know you didn't get, the Maldives. The Maldives. That's a scattering of coral atolls in the southern Indian Ocean. The highest natural point in the Maldives is only 7.5 feet above sea level. The Maldives, as well as being the world's flattest country, it's also the world's smallest Muslim nation, the practice of other religions being prohibited by law to the 300,000 citizens of the Maldives. Now, since it's a Muslim nation, you know that crazy things are going to happen there. Although, I'm just going to break off from my main narrative here to just grumble about countries having names that start with the. I thought we got rid of this, actually. When I was a kid, the world was full of the countries. There was the Lebanon, the Ukraine, the Argentine, the Philippines. It was a darn nuisance. France has a government that you can call the French government. But what do you call the government of a the country? The Lebanon's government? If the inhabitants of Germany are the Germans, what are the inhabitants of the Ukraine? The Ukrainians? Okay, that's my grumble. Now back to our regular scheduled programming. Where was I? Oh yes, the Maldives, the Maldives. Well, since 1978, the president of this peculiar nation has been a bloke euphoniously named Mamoum Gayoum, which sounds like the setup to one of those old jokes, you know. If Claire Bloom had married Mohammed al-Badr, the former king of North Yemen, and then after being widowed she had remarried to Mamoum Gayoum, would it be proper to address her as Claire Gayoum Badr Bloom? No, never mind. Well, President Gayoum's 90% vote in the 2003 elections would have humiliated the other candidates, if there had been any, which of course there weren't. Well, President Gayoum was the subject of an assassination attempt January 8th, when a bearded young man shouting, "God is great," went at him with a knife. The president was saved by a 15-year-old boy scout who had turned out with his troop in full scout kit to greet the nation's leader. This lad grabbed the knife blade at some injury to himself and is now a national hero, sitting up in his hospital bed telling relays of reporters that he was acting on the Boy Scout motto, "Be prepared." Well, it's good to know that the scouts are on our side in the conflict with Islamic terrorism. With the highest point of your territory only 7 feet above sea level, though, if global warming turns out to be a reality, the Maldivians had better be prepared for a really long swim. Ah, the Middle East. "Ship me somewheres east of Suez," pleaded Kipling's soldier. The further east the better would be my preference. Countries like Burma and North Korea are havens of sanity and good government compared with some of these hellholes in the Arab world. Take the Gaza Strip, for instance. Now run by Hamas, a fanatical terrorist organisation financed by our dear friends in Saudi Arabia, the Gaza Strip is basically a welfare slum. Most of its inhabitants live in refugee camps, and they are clothed and fed by the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. What are they refugees from? Well, actually, they're refugees from the War of Annihilation that the Arabs launched against the infant state of Israel back in 1948. That war didn't work out quite as planned. Israel remains unannihilated, and Arabs who ran from the fighting are still vegetating in those camps on the UN dole 60 years later. Back in 1948, Europe was full of refugees from World War II, millions of them, in fact. But to their very great good fortune, they did not have a UN agency to keep them in a state of permanent dependency. Nor did they have 300 million ethnic brothers who refused to absorb them, seeing more to profit from in keeping them poor and displaced. Well, there's the Gaza Strip for you. Hot and dusty welfare slum run by a gang of crazy terrorists. What the crazy terrorists most like to do is they like to lob high explosive missiles over their borders into Israeli towns and villages. This naturally irks the Israelis, who retaliate by sending planes on bombing runs into Gaza. So not only is Gaza a hot, dusty welfare slum run by lunatics, it is also subject to occasional bombing. Great place, eh? Before you rush off to book tickets for your next vacation there, though, note that things have been getting worse recently in the Gaza Strip, if you can imagine that. Fed up with having their citizens killed, the Israelis have blockaded the stinking place. Gazans have reacted by tearing down the wall that separates them from their only other neighbour, that would be Egypt. Now, Egypt is a country that, to put it very, very mildly, does not tolerate Islamic terrorist groups. They have spent much of the past half a century trying to put down the Muslim Brotherhood, which is one such group. Hamas, which runs the Gaza Strip, got its start as an offshoot of that same Muslim Brotherhood. So you can imagine how the Egyptian government feels watching Gazans pull down the wall that kept them out of Egypt. On the other hand, of course, the Gazans are Egypt's poor, poor Arab brothers and sisters, who have been so cruelly treated by those evil Zionists and their Western puppets. I don't know what the Arabic is for cognitive dissonance, but I'll guarantee that there are some heated arguments going on among Egyptian leaders right now. Chances are there'll be tears before bedtime. Okay, it's Thursday night here in Radio Derb space-time, and I'm going to watch this Republican candidate debate in Florida. I haven't watched too many of these debates, and it's time I made up. I shall report back shortly. Meanwhile, here is some soothing music to keep you tuned until I get back. Okay, sat through an entire candidate debate there. Well, I'd better admit I dozed off for a while in the middle. I'm sorry, but, I mean, face it, it was all a bit wonkish, wasn't it? It's great that these guys are all briefed up to the nose holes on things like federal disaster insurance and alternative energy sources. But, you know, if you're sitting there in a really comfortable armchair and you had that extra glass of wine at dinner, well, an hour and a half of politics is about an hour too much. I was glad to see how good-natured it all was, though, and how much these guys all like each other, or at least don't dislike each other so much that they can't keep it well hidden. McCain called Ron Paul Ron. Giuliani called McCain John. So much more relaxing than watching those beastly Democrats snarling and spitting at each other. A bit too relaxing in my case, but I've already apologised for that. OK, here's the roundup. Romney, smart, capable, likeable, for the first time as far as I'm concerned, and boring as all hell. McCain, less smart, less boring, probably just as capable, but wrong about too many things. Very, very nice tribute to Rudy at the end there, though. Giuliani, uninspiring, till we got to that question about the New York Times, when I suddenly remembered why I favoured him. No, that's not liked, that's favoured. If you like Rudy Giuliani, you need help. Huckabee, funny, likeable as all get out. I wouldn't trust him to mail a letter. Paul talked plain good sense with conviction. He's supposed to be the nutty one? Bottom line, Paul the clear winner, but Romney did well, and nobody disgraced himself or our party. OK, here's our closing miscellany of minor items. Item. Something new to worry about. The planet is running out of dirt. David Montgomery, a geologist at the University of Washington, tells us that the average depth of topsoil on our planet is only 3 feet, and modern agricultural methods are depleting it by 1% a year. Mr. Montgomery has written a book with the title Dirt, to draw attention to the issue. Dirt. We're running out of the stuff. Well, that'll put the Clintons out of business, won't it? Item. Chuck Norris said that John McCain is too old to be president. Lashing back, McCain said, quote, I'm going to send my 95-year-old mother to just go over and wash Chuck Norris's mouth out with soap, end quote. Well, lots of luck with that, man. It should make great reality TV, anyway. Item, our president came back from his Middle East trip with the same thing that our presidents always come back with when they visit that part of the world. A great big wedgie. No, said the Gulf states, we can't pump any more oil. We're pumping all we can. Sure, said the Palestinians, we'll stop lobbing missiles into Israel. Except that, oops, sorry, we have absolutely no control over the guys who are lobbing them. And sorry, said the Saudis, we don't believe what you're telling us about the Iranian nuclear threat. We'd rather believe what your own national intelligence estimate said. And, you know, said the Israelis, we'd love to get those settlements out of the West Bank, but there's just too much public opposition. This is a democracy, after all. That's why you support us, right? Oh, and the Saudis did agree to buy a ton of military stuff from us, but only if Congress approves it, and if the British, French and Russians don't undercut us on price. Great trip, Mr. President. Is that Middle East a fun place or what? Item. One more Joshua here. This is an evangelist preacher in Liberia, West Africa, who uses the name Joshua, but whose actual name is Milton Blahi. Before he got religion, this Joshua was a commander in one of Liberia's rebel armies during the Civil War of the 1990s. Quote from the BBC News item, quote, Mr. Blahi stopped fighting in 1996, saying that God appeared to him as he was charging naked into battle and told him he was doing Satan's work, end quote. Say what? Oh, did I mention that the 37-year-old Joshua was known during his military career as General Butt Naked? Because he went into combat with no clothes on, to scare the enemy. He says he's now ashamed of that. He's also ashamed of having killed small children and eaten their hearts as preparation for battle. Oh, heck, Josh, we've all done things we regret, you know. item. The New York Philharmonic will play a concert in Pyongyang, the North Korean capital, February 26th. Our own Jay Nordlinger has written a great piece about this for National Review. It's not clear whether dear leader Kim Jong-il will be attending the concert. I can guarantee, however, that one tune they will not be playing is that solo that the dear leader sings in the movie Team America. I'm lonely, so lonely and sadly alone. Item. Over there in the mother country, a young chap and his lady friend were stopped from getting on a bus. 25-year-old Danny Graves and his fiancée claim that they were discriminated against by the bus company. Why weren't they let on the bus? Well, because the driver judged that Mr. Graves' girlfriend might be in danger if the bus were to brake sharply. Why would he think that? Ah, well, you see, the young lady wears a dog collar. Not the clerical type of dog collar, this is an actual dog's collar. She also wears a leash, a regular dog's leash, and Mr. Graves, her fiancé, is at the other end, holding the leash. Explains Mr. Graves, quote, "The use of the leash is a sign of trust. She's very animal-like. She's kind of like a pet as well as a partner." End quote. Mr. Graves said he does everything for the lady, including laying out clothes for her and feeding her and cleaning their house. After all, as Mr. Graves says, quote again, "You wouldn't expect your cat or your dog to wash the dishes." Well, no, of course you wouldn't. Vain to speculate, I suppose, about the more intimate details of this couple's life together. I do hope, though, that when they're out walking, Mr. Graves behaves as a responsible pet owner should, especially if his fiancée wanders onto the neighbour's lawns. I haven't seen that last item reported in the American newspapers anywhere, so I guess you could call it a scoop. Okay, well, with that I must leave you. I have columns to write, books to review, and indeed a book to write, not to mention, of course, children to raise and a wife to please. What I don't have anymore, since the last Radio Derb, is a little old bundle of dog to talk to and walk with and help me stay sane and focused. We miss you, Boris, but thanks for 15.5 years of the most love a creature ever gave to a family. Now here's another guy with an acoustic guitar, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, the Jewish cowboy.
Now old Seppy is gone, where the good dog is gone, and no more with old Sepp will I roam. But if dogs have a heaven, there's one thing I know. Oh, Shep has a one.